Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus. This is the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. My name's Kyle Anderson. Thank you for joining us. This week, we are going to be talking about only a legend. Nothing too major. We were trying to figure out a time when that would be like most appropriate to talk about this person. And then we realized that it's never not the right time to talk about this person, because sure, we could save it for Halloween because generally horror stuff, but like his name and like influence are so ubiquitous that we may as well talk about it now. And that person is, of course, Stephen King, the I don't know, the best-selling author of all time or something like that. Like like he definitely has the most books of any modern person. Maybe Danielle I haven't done any looking. Please put your blackberries down. Stop trying. I don't know. What do people? Anyway, yeah, that voice you heard is one of the most luminous horror minds in the game. I don't know if that's true, but she's my coworker. She's my friend, and she is a big horror fan. Welcome, please, back to the show, Allison Mattingly. Hi, Allie.
Hi. Thank you so much. I feel like you're overselling me on my. Prolificness in the horror world, but well, I do enjoy horror and I do enjoy Stephen King.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was sort of like I've read a good amount of Stephen King. I won't say that I haven't read anywhere close to all of Stephen King. So it's it's like, am I an, like, I would say I'm a fan. But it's like, yeah. At what point do you have to know everything? Like, I'm not a completist when it comes to King, the way I am with authors. But
I mean, well, like you said, he's written so much. Like, I don't even know like how many like novels, and then you have the short story collections. I mean, he has several that he wrote under, you know, his pseudonyms. Mm-hmm. And is that the right word?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, but yeah, like I remember at one point, like a couple, like over, like when the pandemic first started, I was like, I'm going to read like all the Stephen King books. I looked at like a list, and that did not happen. But I did read a few.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And they're, you know, but some of them you look at and they're just, I mean, granted, he wrote quite a lot of them when he was on cocaine.
Oh, yeah.
But like some of them are so big. Like, it is such a huge book. The book it is about It the Clown. It is such a big,
who's on first big,
it but like The Stand is also really huge.
Yeah, those were the two that I read during the pandemic. Yeah, which I felt like The Stand was just appropriate for that time.
Totally I think I actually remember hearing a lot of people reading The Stand during COVID just for that reason.
Yeah, like I remember like the Libby app was like it was a very long wait time if you wanted to get the audiobook for The Stand, so I just ended up buying it on Audible. But yeah, those are like two massive books.
Yeah.
And there are several. I think Under the Dome is also a very long one. Mm-hmm. The 11 whatever, the JFK assassination one is also pretty hefty.
112263.
Yes.
112263.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So like he's been, since you and I have both been alive, he's been famous and well regarded. But it feels like within the last 5-6 years, like he's come back into huge prominence where people like who grew up reading his books are now reading or like making stuff out of his books. And like we had that whole Castle Rock series, which was imperfect, but like there's a really interesting idea of like,
yeah,
let's contextualize all of Stephen King's oeuvre into one town or one area. First season was pretty good. The second season I don't think was as successful, but
yeah, I watched like the first like episode or two of season two, and yeah, I wasn't really as into it. But yeah, I mean, it's like he really has cultivated such a style and an atmosphere, and I mean it's a very diverse style at the same time. You know, the range of his writing is very, you know, in addition to just like quantity, mm-hmm. You know, really like, you know, running the gambit from like, you know, very intense, you know, psychological horror, and something more grounded like Misery. You have more out there stuff, for better or worse, during, especially, I'm sure, very, very fueled by drugs, like, you know, the Langoliers. And even It is a very out there book, especially. And, you know, but then at the same time, you also have stuff like The Green Mile and Shawshank Redemption, which are just fantastic, you know, obviously short stories in a literary context, but the movies are fantastic too, which I guess is what we're primarily going to talk about today, are movies, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of those movies and TV miniseries. Like he was the
miniseries,
king, back in the 90s. I mean, the Langoliers you mentioned, but like It was there, and there was another big one. But there, I can't remember offhand, but there was, that all started with
Stands. Was also,
The Stand, you're right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was a huge one in the 90s. And The Shining, they did like a literary adaptation. Of,
weird, yeah, TV adaptation.
Which was actually filmed at the Stanley Hotel in Colorado.
Oh, really?
I remember, yeah, it went when I was, when that came out, 94, I guess. So I was 10. My grandparents drove us up to Estes Park. When they were filming that, just, and we couldn't like see, but there were, you know, cameras and lights and stuff like that outside, but that was as close as we could get. But
yeah, but yeah, I mean, you're right, there has been a much like a really like big resurgence, I feel like, in the last, like, you know, 5 to 10 years, because, you know, in the 2000s it was like it kind of died down, like you got a few things, but like, I mean, I feel like Frank Darabont was kind of like the Stephen King guy for a while, and now you have sort of like Mike Flanagan really leading the charge, I feel like, with a lot of, he was, I feel, very responsible for the modern resurgence, because I think his first one was Gerald's Game for Netflix, which is fantastic. I really love that adaptation.
Really good, yeah.
But yeah, then Dr. Sleep, he did
gosh.
Well, I mean, he's working on a lot of stuff now.
He's working on The Stand. I would say that, like, I guess there's another one coming out at some point, TBA, but called The Life of Chuck, which is a novella from a fairly recent.
Yeah.
I think it's 2020. Yeah, it was in a collection from 2020. So yeah, very new. But he's also doing The Dark Tower as a, as a series on Amazon. And you could look at, I mean, Flanagan has been very open about the fact that King is a big influence on him, and it's very evident in his work. But you can look at Midnight Mass.
Oh my God,
which was an original work of Flanagan's, but it's heavily influenced by a lot of different Stephen King things. It's taking place in the Northeast, also on like a secluded little town. You know, it's got a lot of Salem's Lot in it. It's got a lot of you know, stuff about faith, which is really big in Stephen King's work. And so yeah, I found that really, it looks like, so like you said, in the 2000s, we had a few kind of like breakout films. The best of, I mean, the Mist, certainly in 2007, there was The Mist, but there was also 1408, which I thought was good. It's not like the best movie ever made, but I thought it was quite good.
Yeah, for the stuff coming out at the time, I think it was one of the better ones. Certainly better than like Dreamcatcher or Secret Window.
Yeah, Secret Window I didn't like very much. Dreamcatcher is just terrible. Then you get, so, and then there's a couple other like pretty bad ones. But then 2017 was a huge year because you had Gerald's Game, as you mentioned. There's the first It movie, which was riding on the success of Stranger Things. And so they basically only focused on the first part of the novel, which is all about the kids, or I guess chronologically the first part of the novel.
Yeah.
And then also 1922, which isn't very good. Or maybe it is very good. Actually, I don't remember. I don't think I ever saw that one. And then the Dark Tower film adaptation, which is very bad.
Yeah. That's why I'm hoping that Mike Flanagan can do do that series justice.
I think he will. And I think that
if anyone can,
it's him. Yeah.
Yeah. I also liked in 2019, In the Tall Grass, like Netflix has had like a lot of really interesting, like obscure sort of King adaptations in that period with Gerald's Game and then In the Tall Grass, and I believe 1922 was also in
that. Yeah, that was also
But yeah, I really In the Tall Grass was an interesting one. But to me, the like where it all kind of came together, I mean, obviously It was a really big one, but Dr. Sleep was such an interesting adaptation to me, and where I really gained a lot of respect for Mike Flanagan, not only as like just a general director, but as like a Stephen King adaptationist, just because like I feel like that, like he was given just like a super difficult task of adapting not only the novel, which is like, you know, obviously a direct sequel to the book The Shining, but also Warner Brothers obviously wanted it to be a sequel to the Stanley Kubrick movie The Shining, which if you do not know is very different from King's novel, and so I really loved the way that he found a way to blend those two and adapt and stay faithful to King's novels, both the original and the sequel, as well as the Kubrick film, which notoriously Stephen King hated, and made something that I believe King has said that he really enjoyed.
There's some of that stuff, like he said he liked the Dark Tower movie, which there's no way he did, but some of that stuff is he's being paid to do so, but I legitimately don't think he would lie about Mike Flanagan project in that way. And I'm with you. Like, so in the lead up to that movie, I actually got to do a lot of cool Dr. Sleep stuff, which you can read on Nerdist.com. But like, I got to, when that movie was coming out, I got to go to Estes Park to stay at the Stanley Hotel, interview Flanagan, and then see what was essentially, I think, the premiere of the film in Estes Park, Colorado, like with the locals and everything. Which was huge, because that's, you know, the thing about the Stanley Hotel is it itself is not haunted, but they have really played up the fact that, oh, this is the Shining thing. So they like, they give you ghost tours, but like it has traditionally never been haunted. That was the whole point of King's like staying there, was like, it's the emptiness of the hotel that's scary.
Yeah.
It's not that there's ghosts, it's that it's an empty old hotel.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that I was like all in on that. So I reread The Shining and then read Dr. Sleep, which I hadn't yet read, and was just like, oh boy, how is he going to adapt all, you know, because famously at the end of the book, the Overlook explodes. But at the end of the movie, it remains. And so like they, you know, in the book, they go to the place where the hotel was, but in the movie they actually go to the hotel. So and it's a completely different type of movie. Like The Shining is just about isolation and you know, creeping madness with, you know, supernatural elements and stuff like that, but the second one is like effectively an X-Men vampire story. Like it's like there are vampires who suck the mutant powers out of people with The Shining, and it's like that is such a strange concept. And I don't think it's an amazing, no, you know what, I think it's a good movie. I think it's a good movie. I would have never, go ahead.
So have you seen the director's cut?
No, I haven't actually.
I highly recommend the director's cut. It's very, very good. The pacing and everything I feel like is just so well done, and it feels much more like watching a King novel. In terms of that pacing and structure and everything, if that makes sense. I always recommend people watch the director's cut. I think it's fantastic.
I will do that. I have it. I just haven't actually ever cracked it open. So that was very much like we are in Stephen King's world. And that was right around the time that Castle Rock was coming out. And so like 2017, where there were four adaptations, 2019 there were three or four adaptations, because you also had Pet Sematary, which I was not good, but it was another big Stephen King movie remake.
It was. Yeah. I mean, like, again, like I appreciate in this time a lot of like the risks, guess, that people were taking with his work. Because I will say, like, I was very intrigued by, like, the trailers to the new Pet Sematary when it revealed that, you know, in that version, the opposite child died. Because I think that that is, like, I love the original Pet Sematary. It's one of my favorite King adaptations. But I do think you have the challenge of having such a young character. Not necessarily, like, I'm fine with I'm fine with killing young children in film.
Isolate that. I'm clipping that out. I'm isolating that.
But I'm fine with, like, the narrative, like, aspects of it, but I understand, like, the practical challenges of it from a filmmaking standpoint of having a character where, like, in the novel, it works really well to have, I'm blanking on his name, the child in Pet Sematary.
Gage.
You know, in the novel, it works really well because, you know, it's a novel and, you know, you don't have to have a literal toddler performing in the climax of the book. Whereas in the movie, you know, it's just not as effective with the limited acting talents of a child. Yeah. And so I think having it be the older child, the daughter, Ellie, in the new version was a really interesting and good choice to have. And it also plays a lot more with the themes of the novel and how her relationship to her father and the concepts of death and everything. It makes it a lot more interesting and dynamic. I think it was just in the execution of it just really fell flat for me in the final movie.
It was very much a an example of you're doing all the things that a Stephen King adaptation should do, but it's it lacked the sauce, I guess, you know, like the kind of who knows what that you know. And then I never watched the prequel.
Pet Sematary
Bloodline.
I haven't watched it either.
It's supposed to be very bad. It's such a creepy idea, and I'm with you. I think the Mary Lambert original is really good.
Yeah.
And definitely, like, you know, it's still that kind of, like, late 80s, I think. Yeah, 90. Late 80s or early 90s, like, schlock version of Stephen King. But she's able to, I mean, she's a very good director, can elevate it to something a little bit more you know, thought provoking and stuff, while you still have, you know, the mangled ghost kid who walks around and stuff. But it's such a creepy idea. Like, you bury stuff in here and it comes back, but it's, you know, it's messed up and stuff, and something evil kind of comes back. And I love the line, you know, sometimes dead is better, which is just like, that's a classic line.
It's definitely probably, I don't know, it's so hard for me to pick a favorite novel. But I feel like Pet Sematary is probably my favorite. It's just such a great, chilling story. Mm. And that is what I feel like the original movie captured a lot more. Like the new one, it just felt like it was trying to do too much in a way, with, like, the kids walking around with the masks and stuff in the woods. Yeah. Like, it just, like, it felt like it was straying too far away from, like, what the original novel was trying to do and what made the original novel so effective. I don't know. I am curious to watch Bloodlines. But I want them to make a really good, like, faithful adaptation. And, like, even though I just said I like it when they take risks and take big swings and stuff, I would love to see, like, not necessarily, like, you know, it doesn't have to be exact, but in terms of, like, the spirit of it, like, love, like, just, like, I feel like that's when King is most effective, is when it's just, like, really, like, just, I don't know, it just sits with you, and, like, it just gets in your bones. Mm. Speaking of which, I will segue this to another one of my favorite Stephen King adaptations, which is Misery. Because I feel like that's a similar sort of thing, where it's like, that is like Pet Sematary, the original movie, I think so effectively executes that sort of, like, just really putting you into a situation introducing you to these characters and just letting you sit in this like uncomfortable mounting tension.
You know, here's an interesting thing about Misery, because they I remember that movie coming out. It came out in 1990, and it was very, I mean, I was a child, so I didn't watch it. But I remember it being a big thing. Like, it was, you know, won Oscars and stuff like that. Kathy Bates obviously won her Oscar for that movie. And is great. Like, she is legitimately great in that movie. I watched it a few years ago when they put out like the anniversary Blu-ray of it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think it's a very good movie overall. That's one I've not read, so I can't compare and contrast or anything like that. I think the story is solid, but I think it makes some weird editing choices, and the pacing is very strange, and it just was sort of like the hobbling scene, which is infamous. Yeah. The next scene, he like, there's no sign of it. Like, you could excise that whole sequence and it wouldn't change the movie at all.
Yeah, that is. So like Misery was one of the books I read as well over 2020. And I will say that after reading it, it did change my perspective on the adaptation a lot more. Mm-hmm. 'Cause like before, I would have said that, like, Misery was my favorite adaptation. Or just like my favorite Stephen King movie. But then having read the book, yeah, like there is a lot of that where it's like the book goes so really hard putting you in the mindset of the James Caan character. Mm-hmm. And it's like half the horror is just really feeling his desperation and like his, like there's like a whole scene where like he has to like go and try and get his like painkillers from the from the bathroom while she's out, because he's just like so desperate for it, and like you really feel the desperation in the book. And yeah, like I rewatched the adaptation afterwards, and I was just like, James Caan is just like, seems fine. Like, other than like he can't walk, like his character seems totally like just very chill. And like, even after, like you said, like the hobbling scene, it's just like there's no real like sense of like physical urgency or physical like struggle for his character. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but like the hobbling scene is like unique to the movie.
I did know that. Yeah.
She cuts off his foot. So yeah. It's like, I do think that was a really, again, an interesting change and a choice, because I will say the hobbling scene is very like, it'll make you squirm.
Yeah. Just as a scene, it's like amazing.
Very and,
like,
effective.
The fact that it's like, you know, you just see, I mean, it's all, I'm a big, like, how they do that gore effect guy. And so like, you know, the feet are, like, you see her put the log in between his actual feet, and then they cut to her, I think. And then they cut back to the wide shot, and they're the fake feet, and then she just does it. And it's just as simple, and the foot just goes clunk and, like, on a hinge. And it's amazing. And he screams in agony, and it's, like, incredibly effective. But then, like, then they cut to Richard Farnsworth again, I think. And then when they cut back to James Caan, he's just sitting in the wheelchair looking out the window, like, smoking and, like, typing. And it's just like, so what was the point? Like, so you still can't walk. That's the ultimate thing, is that, like, again, if we'd have just cut that scene out, it changes nothing about the actual film.
Yeah.
Which I think is a, you know, that's the mark of not particularly good pacing or not good, I don't know, structure in some fashion. So that was where I was kind of, like, surprised about. Also, you know, as I have seen The Shining 6 million times.
Yeah.
And I know this doesn't happen in the book, but Scatman Crothers spends the entire movie trying to get back to the Overlook and then immediately gets killed. That's a Stanley Kubrick thing, I think, was a mistake, because I like that character and everything like that. So that's not in, excuse me, that's not in the book. However, Misery, the movie, adapting the book, Richard Farnsworth spends the entire movie trying to figure out what's going on and where this guy went. And then she just immediately just kills him with a shotgun. It's like, what's the point? I can't stand stuff like that.
I mean, there is, it does happen in the book. I'm trying to remember. It's been a few years since I've read it, but it's like, I do remember, like, there is a cop that comes Because like I think it's not an exact like one-to-one adaptation with like that character, but there is a cop who comes to like investigate, and she ends up running him over with a lawnmower in the book.
Oh wow.
So it's like she's much more menacing, I feel like, in the book, and much more of a like a threat than I mean, not to discount oh my god, I am blanking on so many names today, who plays Annie in the movie.
But Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates. Oh my god. I'm usually so good with names. Famous names. I'm very bad when people introduce themselves to me, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, her character, she's very effective in the movie, but like in the book, like there's just like an extra level of like unhinged unpredictability that they build up to. Because yeah, it is kind of anticlimactic when it's just like, oh, very quick like shotgun death to the cop in the movie. But and she's also like very Terminator in the in the book as well, where it's just like it takes a good healthy beating and a lot of different like things to try and like finally take her.
Yeah, and like there's so much more. I mean, even just kind of like glancing at the plot synopsis of the book, like she does a lot more. Like she cuts off Paul's thumb and stuff like that. She like really goes to town on him. And then there's the realization that, oh, she's killed a lot of people. Like she's not. This isn't like a new thing for her. Like she's actually like a pretty horrible.
I think they kind of allude to it in the movie, but like I do remember them like going very in depth in the book about like all the people she's killed. And then she like keeps like a scrapbook of like of her victims. And I think she's like notoriously like one of the big things was that she was like, I think killing babies. Like she was like a maternity ward nurse or something like that. And so like that was like her big like initial claim to fame that got her fired.
Yeah, which they play up a little bit in Castle movie. Rock season two. And I actually do think that Lizzie Kaplan, who plays her young version of Annie in the show, I think does a really good job, but is doing a Kathy Bates impression the whole time. Like she didn't get out of the cock-a-doodie car. Like it's ridiculous. Hilarious as well. But what I find really interesting about that book is that most of Stephen King's books are somewhat autobiographical. Like,
yeah.
And I like the fact that that one was kind of based on, he had written The Eyes of the Dragon, which is a fantasy novel. And people were angry at him that it wasn't a horror book. And so he's just like, so this is my one thing that I do. And like, you know, but it feels really like, you know, that the movie came out in 1990 and you're like, oh wow, obsessed fans are terrible. But how many like people today are like with various franchises I could name but won't are like entitled to what they want, and so like they get really annoyed or even like belligerent and stuff like if that doesn't happen. I feels like, boy, he was really on the cutting edge of that stuff.
Oh yeah. And was this, I can't remember, did the novel come out before or after his like real life car crash?
That is a good question.
I think, because I thought like originally too, like he's spoken about how like the novel is meant to be like a more so like a metaphor, like Annie is a metaphor for his addiction. But I can't remember if the car crash happened before or after the novel came out.
It was after.
It was after.
It was 1999 is the car crash.
Oh yeah.
So that is interesting too, because yeah, he was kind of laid up there for a while.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So let's. I want to talk about. Like we were already kind of talking about our favorite adaptations, but I kind of want to go chronologically through some of the bigger ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
So right out of the gate, you have Brian De Palma's Carrie, which is a great movie.
Yeah.
A really upsetting movie, and maybe like. I mean, it might be De Palma's best movie. Like, I'm not a huge De Palma fan. I find him really interesting, but I also find him very flawed and kind of irritating.
Yeah.
Just admit you're ripping off Hitchcock. Just, we know you're doing it. Did you ever see that documentary where it's just Noah Baumbach talking to him at a table?
No.
It's really interesting. I mean, it's, you know, it goes film by film. It's just the two of them talking and stuff. But like, you know, Baumbach brings up like, you know, there's a lot of Hitchcock in your movie. And he's like, I think we were all inspired by Alfred Hitchcock at the time. And it's like, no, you legitimately just ripped off Hitchcock, like point for point in some cases. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But Carrie, I think, is outstanding. And yeah. as an adaptation of King's first book, first novel, it's I think, you know, that book is not like as in depth as as a lot of his later stuff would be. And so I think it's a little easier to adapt it as a straightforward film. But I do think he does like a really, really great job with it. Actually, King's first three novels all got made into something because Salem's Lot was the second book, but it got made into a TV movie, miniseries. Legitimately could just be a feature length movie. There's a lot of faff in that miniseries. Nothing really happens until the end of the first part.
Yeah. But I mean, like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a bit. But like all of them, like, have such like iconic, like, even if like the overall like whole of them aren't are debatably like of debatable quality, but like, yeah, like Carrie, The Shining, and Salem's Lot are like three like very like iconic adaptations, like right out the gate.
Yeah. And
so like, and to have that in both mediums is really interesting.
Absolutely. And I think like, by that point, it was like we were off and running, you know, like 83 alone, you had Cujo, The Dead Zone, and Christine. And I actually think it, for what they are, all three of them are really good.
Oh, yeah. Cujo is fantastic. I mean, like, you know, it's a very like, I don't know. You think like, how do you make this work for a feature length film? But like, I feel like it's still like, I rewatched it like a year or so ago, and it's still a very effective movie.
Yeah, and I guess I missed Creepshow, which I love. I love Creepshow.
Oh, Creepshow is so good.
And it does adapt a couple of his short stories, but he wrote the screenplay for it, and he's in it, and it's a very silly section of the book, but or the film, but but yeah, Cujo, I think it's definitely the one of those three that I've seen the least. But I don't think it's not for lack of it being like I don't enjoy it. Like I think it's a really tense and effective movie, and it just, you feel the heat of that movie, like they're just sitting in this car roasting to death because it's the 70s or the early 80s and the car is old and they don't have good air conditioning and whatever. And Lewis Teague directed that one, who's he directed also Cat's Eye, but also Alligator, which is a movie I really love.
Oh, nice.
But then The Dead Zone by Cronenberg, which is like Cronenberg's like least, or at least for the time, like a very restrained film for Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Kind of a strange choice because like right after that, he would make The Fly. And right before that, he made Videodrome. Or maybe that's the same year Videodrome came out.
Yeah.
Like it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, same year.
And then Christine, of course, which was, I think the novel was written while they were like in tandem with the screenplay. And then Carpenter made that because The Thing had done so poorly, so he wanted to make something a little more mainstream,
commercial.
And I like Christine. I think I could, you know, it's there's a lot of good in Christine. I think of those three, Dead Zone I think is the clear, like, I don't know, champagne Stephen King movie.
I mean, like, I prefer Cujo, but that just me, like I really love a Stephen King movie or story where it's just like simple scenario and just letting you sit in it, which I don't know, maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's what some of his best stuff is just you know, Gerald's Game is a movie or is a book that like most people thought could never be a movie because it's literally just a woman thinking to herself.
Yeah, but it's so effective.
The movie's so amazing. Good. Yeah.
But the scene with the handcuff.
It's if you've not seen Gerald's Game, it's on Netflix, please watch it. It's excellent.
So good.
Carla Gugino, the ghost of Bruce Greenwood, and the guy who played Lurch, and also the fireman in Twin Peaks, that guy, whatever.
Oh, yeah,
Carl Stroyken.
Yeah.
Really interesting movie, but anyway.
Going into the later 80s, we have Children of the Corn, which is
Children of the Corn is the one that's turning 40 this year, which is kind of what prompted this whole discussion. Yeah. So Children of the Corn, I think, is not a good movie, but it's also great.
I think that's when we start to really get into like the camp. King era.
Yes. And people really start like you know, given they're like, we know what this is. Like, they're not as faithful. They don't kind of take the text quite as much as, as, you know, like as gospel as it were, I guess. So there's so much about the movie that just leaves out what's really interesting about the story, which is like all the weird Lovecraftian stuff, which is in a lot of his work, which I love. I think a few years ago, maybe around the time It came out, I wrote a whole piece about the Lovecraftian influences on Stephen King. And so I was going like, what are the outer gods in King's work that are in Lovecraft? And that was really fun, I have to say. But there's that the entity in the corn that the children worship.
Yeah.
Is just not particularly well like shown in the film.
I mean, I feel like that was the challenge of like early King adaptations. I mean, even today, like I feel like there's a really it's just so hard that like that specific component of horror from like a novel medium is just it's so difficult to translate. That's why I feel like, you know, the new ones really did their best and like made it more effective than I think the Tim Curry version for like the finale. But like, it's just those like his like concepts with that more cosmic Lovecraftian horror are just like, I feel like where it gets really difficult to adapt to a screen format.
And like, you know, I think the first, I mean, this is jumping the gun, but I think the first It feature film is is good. Like, I think it's quite good. I think the second one really suffers from, because that's the less interesting part of the novel. And it's like, well, let's make a whole movie of the stuff where they're just shitty adults. Who basically have to go through the same scares as the first movie. Like,
I do like it. Part two. I would like to see like a version that is like maybe like half an hour to 45 minutes shorter.
Completely agree there. Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, I don't know, at the time I really liked part one in that they made that decision to do like entirely focus on them as kids. But also like, I think part of the reason why, like you said, it's like all the adult stuff is like the least interesting. So it's just like, I feel like maybe you needed to blend it throughout more for both movies rather than just like pushing it all to part two. And then like weaving in like a little bit of extra kid stuff where it's like, okay, we kind of are like, it's like, yeah, like I appreciated seeing like the Richie flashbacks and stuff like that. But then like, okay, but why didn't you, we saw this already in part one, like essentially like in terms of like that same sort of like narrative beat.
Yeah. And there were some bits that I thought were legitimately, you know, Andy Muschietti is an interesting director.
Yeah.
He gets a lot of that, like the moment to moment stuff. Like but you know, I definitely think that there was a lot in part two that just was like, we saw this one already. Yeah. Like,
I will say that the cast saves it. Like casting is so perfect on the adult counterparts that I really enjoyed just like seeing them and watching them interact and stuff. And I love Bill Hader. I could watch him do anything.
Oh yeah. And he was, you're absolutely right. He's the perfect choice for that. And way better than like, just, I know people like Tim Curry as Pennywise, and I think like he's, you know, rightfully iconic, and it scared the crap out of us when we were little kids. But I think in terms of the rest of the cast, like Harry Anderson, come on. Like, I like Harry Anderson on Night Court. I think he's very effective and good comedy magician, but like I just never bought, like, you know, who else was in that as the doll? I think Annette O'Toole was what's her face, and then I know Seth Green was young Richie.
Yeah, was the young Richie.
But yeah, it's still, it was
very forgettable cast, I feel like, other than Tim Curry.
Yeah. Hoo-ha. And the opening scene of the TV movie, come in, Georgie, we all float down here. Like, it's great. That stuff is so
scared
good.
Scared me as a child. My sister tricked me into watching it.
Terrifying clown. It's the reason people, it's not the reason people are scared of clowns.
That doesn't help.
Yeah. No, I guess.
What helps make you more afraid of them? I don't know. It doesn't hurt. I don't know what I'm trying to say.
What are you trying to say?
I don't know. Most of the time.
I don't know. I'm just kidding.
But yeah.
Getting back to 84, the other one that came out in 40 years ago is Firestarter.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
So here's the thing about the movie Firestarter. I can see, because that was going to be John Carpenter, but because of, I think they were still unwilling to give, Universal was unwilling to give him money for it because The Thing had lost them a lot of money.
Oh.
And so they, Mark L. Lester ended up being the director, and he was, he did The Class of 84, which is like a weird, like post-apocalyptic-ish kind of movie about how, about like a school overrun by gangs and stuff like that. It's not a good movie. Oh. But like, I can see when watching the movie Firestarter, how it would have been better if King had, if Carpenter had directed it. And it makes me kind of like it because like it was still, it had the kind of general vibe of a Carpenter movie without it actually being a Carpenter movie. So also Tangerine Dream did the music to it. So I don't necessarily stand by the movie because, you know, I think George C. Scott, who I love, is playing a Native American tracker in the movie, and that is not okay.
I have not seen that movie in forever. That is, that's Drew Barrymore, though, right?
That's the original? Yeah, she plays the titular Firestarter.
Yeah. Did you see the, they did a remake last year with Zac Efron?
I didn't see it because I heard it was awful.
And let's say I did not see it either after I saw the reviews for it, but I was curious. I don't know. That's the thing with the Stephen King adaptations. I feel like it's like what's the saying in Game of Thrones with like the Targaryens, where it's like you flip a coin. It's either.
Oh yeah, yeah. Honestly, that's true, and that's something that's absolutely worth mentioning because there were still a ton of King adaptations in you know the 90s. And some of them were pretty good and some of them were not. And,
yeah.
But when they weren't good, they were very, very bad. It's not like there's like a, you know, a lot of pretty good or just okay Stephen King adaptations because like if we look at feature films, obviously we had Misery, but that same year Graveyard Shift came out, which is currently has a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
I understand that's an old movie, but like, you know,
yeah.
And then you had in 92, the Lawnmower Man.
Oh, we did Lawnmower Man.
Stand By Me and The Running Man both came out in the mid-80s, and those are good.
Yeah.
The Running Man, directed by Paul Michael Glazer, who played Starsky on Starsky and Hutch. That's just a fun fact. But Stand By Me is excellent, and The Running Man with Arnold Schwarzenegger is fun. But anyway, so then you have The Graveyard Shift, which is awful, and then you had Lawnmower Man in 92. Which they really changed a lot to try to make it like virtual reality. And
you gotta get into the future. Those graphics, the CGI in that movie, just and then in 90s,
it's true. I mean, it is something else. I think Jeff Fahey's actually pretty good as the titular Lawnmower Man, but like Pierce Brosnan. Is he a good actor? I don't want to disparage. I think he's a good James Bond, but in so many other things, I'm like, what is he doing? 93, you have The Dark Half, George Romero's The Dark Half, which I actually think is quite good.
Oh, I don't think I've ever seen that one.
It's good. Yeah, it's based on a story of the same name, but it's essentially Timothy Hutton plays an author who writes this evil character who ends up being actualized, and it's literally his like evil side of himself, and it's very much what you'd expect a Stephen King story to be like.
Sounds almost like Secret Window.
It is kind of like Secret Window, actually. It's better than Secret Window.
Yeah.
And then Needful Things, which is a good book, but I don't remember the movie, but I remember people thinking it wasn't good.
Yeah. Then we have The Shawshank Redemption, which is one of my favorite King movies.
I think that is the gold standard for like, I mean, it's obviously not a horror story, but like, I mean, a movie that didn't do very well at the time, like financially.
Yeah.
Got passed over a lot for Oscars because that was a stacked year for Oscars. Losing out to Forrest Gump, as everything did that year. And then it's on TNT 100 times a day.
Yeah, that's like, I was gonna say, I was like, that's like a movie, it's like one of those movies like that, like Goodfellas. It's like when I have access to cable, if like if I'm in a hotel or something and I see the Shawshank Redemption's on, I'm gonna stay up until like 1 a.m watching it. It's just like one of those movies, it just sucks you in no matter what part of the movie it's in or whatever. I don't have to catch it from the beginning, I'll like drop it halfway through, I'm gonna finish that thing.
Yeah, I mean, and you can't like you can't just stop watching that movie. No. It's a movie that like I've seen from the beginning a couple times, but I've watched it from the middle a million times.
exactly. It's just so great. The cast is great. And yeah, I feel like it's like that era of like King where it's like starting to get into like a little bit more of like the prestige. Like you said, it didn't win any Oscars, but then you have like The Green Mile coming out a few years later.
Yeah.
That's just also very fantastic.
Also Frank Darabont, also in that same kind of vein, prison related, Great Depression-ish. And Michael Clarke Duncan is outstanding in that movie. I think he got a Oscar nom for that. I'm pretty sure he did. Should have. And then like Toby Hooper's The Mangler, which is terrible. And also Dolores Claiborne, which is really kind of another highbrow, like more thrillery than horror, but like the book is quite horror-y, but you know, Taylor Hackford directed that one, who is, you know, a well-known director.
Yeah.
And then in 97 they did The Night Flyer, which is I think it was a TV. It's a feature film. Line.
Yeah.
About a vampire on a plane. It's a weird movie. It's definitely a weird movie.
These vampires on this plane.
Yeah, but very small planes. Like a really tiny. It's really bizarre. It's such a strange. It feels almost like it should have been a Tales from the Crypt episode, but it's not. Yeah. Like it's that level of just like Miguel Ferrer plays a tabloid reporter, which is a very Tales from the Crypt profession, and who goes to the small airport and there's a vampire who flies a Cessna. Like it's so strange. And also the vampire has like a big cape and is like strange looking. It's a very, very weird movie. It's often on Sci-Fi Channel, so
I've never seen this, but now I kind of want to.
And then 98 was Apt Pupil, which is a psychological film about a Nazi in a basement, directed by someone who sucks. And then The Green Mile, and then Hearts in Atlantis, which is sort of like a weird offshoot story of The Green, or not The Green Mile, of The Dark Tower. Like it connects to, I became obsessed in college. I still have never read a single Dark Tower novel, but I became obsessed with how the other characters and novels in King's bibliography connect to the Dark Tower. Hearts in Atlantis is one of them.
I've not read, I've only read the first Dark Tower years ago, but I do, like, I remember whenever I was reading Salem's Lot in 2020, and I was like, oh, whatever happened, like, wait, did we find out what happened to the priest character? And I read that he shows up in Dark Tower in the series. Yeah, and then isn't Rick Flagg from The Stand, The Man in Black?
Randall Flagg.
Rick
Flagg is from comic books.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, Randall Flagg. Isn't he also in the Dark Tower series? Isn't he like the main antagonist?
Yes, he is. He's the Man in Black. Essentially, is Randall Flagg. Yeah. Who is essentially, I think I kind of equated him to the Lovecraft character Nyarlathotep, who is literally the black man of evil or whatever. Which Lovecraft, as you might expect, he's a little more racist about it, but but he's sort of like, he's an outer god, and also, but is like the most directly tied to humanity and like needs to, you know, like can walk among them and stuff like that. I find that kind of stuff really interesting. He's the main character. He's the main antagonist, is the same character from The Stand. And then, I used to remember all this stuff, but like Hearts in Atlantis, they made into a film, even though it is, the book itself is a tie-in novella from, the Dark Tower series called Low Men in Yellow Coats. huh. which is a Dark Tower tie-in.
Wow.
Dreamcatcher, we already talked about, is terrible. Secret Window is not good either.
No.
Riding the Bullet is another Mick Garris one.
I don't remember that one.
Mick Garris basically was the de facto king director of TV movies. He did The Shining. He did.
Okay.
Let me see if television adaptation. Does it even say? Come on, man. It doesn't say who directed half of these, but Mick Garris, who is a pretty well-known horror aficionado and director, directed a lot of those. Did he direct the It TV movie? No, he didn't. No, that was Tommy Lee Wallace, who directed Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of TV movies based on his work. So there was Golden Years, The Stand, The Langoliers, They Made The Shining, Storm of the Century, Rose Red.
I've heard really good things about Rose Red. I believe
Rose Red
it
is basically
just
his,
on Hulu.
Yeah, I would recommend watching it. Rose Red is his The Haunting. It's pretty interesting. Kingdom Hospital, which was an adaptation of The Kingdom, which is the Lars von Trier TV series about a haunted hospital. Desperation, which is about an evil sheriff who's somehow a vampire or something. I forget. Several episodes of Under the Dome he wrote.
Under the Dome.
And there have been other adaptations of they've done several TV movies of his, Dreamscapes and whatever.
Yeah.
Nightmares and Dreamscapes, which was a anthology series that they made for a while.
Yeah. They've tried to adapt Salem's Lot a couple of times as a TV miniseries.
Right. Yeah. The one in the early 2000s had Rob Lowe in it.
Yeah, Rob Lowe. Yeah.
They made Sometimes They Come Back, The Tommyknockers. The Tommyknockers was the other one I was thinking of. That was big news when that came out on ABC. Trucks. Oh, yeah, we do. Let's talk a little bit about
Maximum Overdrive. Yes.
Which is based on his story Trucks about cars and things that come to life and try to kill people.
Yes.
And that's the one movie he directed. And he was so high on cocaine the entire time. And that movie is.
You can feel it.
Yeah, you can feel the cocaine. The cocaine sweats are part of the film green. And it's so strange. It is iconic because the main evil truck has a green goblin face on the front, which is awesome. But it's so strange that Marvel allowed that to happen. I guess it was the late 80s and Marvel was fairly.
Needed money.
Strapped for cash, right?
That's Emilio Estevez is the main character in that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. A wild movie.
I was trying to just see who else was in it. Pat Hingle, who played Commissioner Gordon in the Burton movies and the Schumacher movies. Yardley Smith of The Simpsons was in it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh my god.
Also it was weird because it had a bunch of songs
AC/DC, right?
The AC/DC entire soundtrack was AC/DC, which was King's favorite band. And the song Who Made Who, and which is also one of their albums, was the soundtrack to Maximum Overdrive. It's so weird. And Hell's Bells and You Shook Me All Night Long are not on that album, but they are on that soundtrack. So bizarre. Such a strange movie. But I also kind of love it, it's of the period where they weren't good movies, but I kind of love them.
No, I think it's there are some King movies that fall in that so bad they're good category. Mm-hmm. Where it's just so over the top. And there is some really good gore or good violence, some good carnage in that movie too. I think a lot of it got censored, was it a steamroller or that smushes the kid?
Yeah, I think it is a steamroller. Boy, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie.
Yeah,
but
it's been a minute since I've seen it too. But yeah, I just remember there's some like good stuff. There's like this soda machine that throws soda cans at people.
Which they, I think in one of the Transformers movies, they like use that whole bit. Like,
oh, really?
Somebody like, there's like a, is it the second one? I can't really remember, but there's like a virus that can turn any machine into a Transformer, which is ridiculous.
Oh, I think that is the second one, because I've only seen like the first two, and I do remember that. So
yeah, the second one was made while the first, or not the first, but the last writer's strike was happening.
Yeah.
And so there's just a lot of dumb in that movie because there was no one around to tell Bay Michael no, Bay, no, and there was nobody actually around to rewrite the script, so he just made up stuff.
I mean, but is that not how the rest of the Transformers movies are? Again, I have not seen them. I did see Bumblebee. I did like Bumblebee, but the other
Bumblebee
Bay
is
Transformer movies are, from what I have seen of them, seem very questionable.
Yeah. It's,
I don't know.
Anyway, those movies. That's I was going to say that's a whole different tangent. Podcast, but I actually don't want to talk about them.
Yeah. Fair. Back to the 2000s of King movies. We finally, in 2007 was a good year. We got 1408 and The Mist. Mm-hmm.
And The Mist really has stood the test of time and actually changes the ending of the short story, because mm-hmm. the short story is very ambiguous. And Darabont just decided, I mean, he's the trifecta of King adaptations. This is his third. And boy, it just like destroys you. And it's so good. Yeah.
So effective.
If you've had the opportunity to see the black and white cut, it's somehow better. And I don't know why.
It's very, I love watching that movie in black and white. I love it. Again, just like, I know I've said it like 10 times now, but like simple setup, single mm-hmm. location, just letting these characters like stew in the like tension. And you know, you got some like Hallmark King tropes with like the religious themes. You have these like Lovecraftian monsters, you know, you have human monsters that mm-hmm. are just so good.
And you have the ambiguity of like, since they don't know what these creatures are, where they're coming from,
mm-hmm.
you have, you know, Mrs. Carmody is one of the best villains King ever wrote. And I think Marcia Gay Harden plays the living hell out of that role, but who's basically like, this is God's, you know, wrath upon you, and you are the, you know, mm-hmm. the infidels, or what, I shouldn't say infidels, but, and people start believing her, and it's like how quickly people kind of succumb to that kind of fear mongering. And we're seeing, you know, that's another thing we see very easily today, where people just are like, they don't have answers for stuff. And so they turn to the most irrational people, because there is no actual rational, they can't rationalize what's actually happening.
I do love the read though, that like, that is like somewhat like of a ambiguous question at the end, because like, you know, her whole thing was that they needed to sacrifice the kid in order to make it stop. And then it stops, it ends when he kills everybody in the car. So it's like, sorry to spoil it. But you know, it's like, was she right? Did killing the kid end it? Or, you know, so it's like, I've seen readings of it online that like kind of bring that up, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I love The Mist.
It's so good, and I it's been way too long since I've watched it. They recently just put that out on 4K, like upgraded stuff.
I've been meaning to pick the 4K up, because I have like a digital version of it on Vudu, which, as we know, is permanent and the best way of owning media.
That's the only way. If you don't have it in your possession, that's the best way to actually have stuff.
Yeah. But you, I wanted to talk about 1408 real quick, because I know you said this, you really enjoyed this movie. It's been a long time since I've seen
it when it came out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It came out the same year as The Mist. It's much less, but you know what? On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a better score than The Mist. And I think that's just I think The Mist rubbed people the wrong way. 1408 is a real straightforward haunted hotel kind of, where it's about a writer played by John Cusack who whose agent I think is Sam Jackson. Who?
No, Sam Jackson is the hotel owner. Oh,
that's right. You're right. Who basically he in order to write like a book about haunted places, he goes and stays at this hotel, stays in the haunted room 1408, which is a fun kind of like nod back to The Shining, because The Shining is about a haunted room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the book it's 217, in the movie it's 237, but and that, you know, when you go to the Stanley Hotel, that's the most coveted room, that's the one that everybody wants to stay in is 217, because that's The Shining room.
Do they have the bathtub?
I don't know. I feel like that room has to be better than all the other rooms. Like,
oh yeah, I would imagine like you go all out to like replicate that room. I would assume.
You'd imagine so. I mean, like the room that I stayed in was it on three, so it was like down the hallway. It's not a big hotel. I don't know if you've ever been there. It's not.
No,
big.
I haven't. I want to.
It's got a really opulent ballroom, and you know, there's a cool. It has a dedicated whiskey bar with like.
Let's say, how's the bar?
It's great. Oh boy, that place was awesome. Like the menu of whiskeys that you could order from this place was like it's like a pamphlet unto itself. It was amazing. Anyway, so and it feels old. Like it's kind of, you know, they've kept it really vintage, but the room is, you know, it has an old timey bed. It's got carpeting that is kind of gross, and it's just like it was an interesting sort of thing. And it was freezing cold because we went in November before the movie
boiler's broken.
So. That's right. Maybe they did that on purpose. They're like, what if the room was absolutely freezing? But like, and every room has a radiator in it instead of actual heaters. Like, it's just old. It's just an old place. But anyway, so I would be very surprised to hear that they renovated just that one room. Although, who knows? That's the one everybody wants to stay in. But anyway, so 1408, it's like him again doing a reaction to his own kind of mythos, essentially. Yeah. Because that short story came out in 99, which is obviously well after he wrote The Shining and everything like that. And just the mythos around The Shining kind of grew.
I really want to rewatch that now that I'm like, we're talking about it. Cause like, I remember like in middle school, like when it came out, like I, you know, when I was first starting to like really get into horror, I went and rented it with some friends one night from Blockbuster. And it was like, I remember watching it and, you know, I was like, yeah, it's fine. But like, I'd be curious to watch it now.
I saw it one time. I think I watched it on cable or something like that after it came out. And I was just, you know, this is pretty good. I think just as, you know, solid ghost story kind of thing, like with the elements that King always includes, especially with his writer characters of like the growing madness and feeling trapped in a place and just like, you know, like, you know, that was the era of, I don't know, feel like pull the rug out horror movies, because there was also, another John Cusack movie was Identity from a few years before that. It's a pull the rug out kind of movie.
Very, like trippy. Pull the rug out, twist ending. Yeah, that was a really big time for twist endings, in movies.
I mean, even The Mist is kind of it's not twist, it's a swerve, but it's an interesting ending.
Because I mean, that was also like, I feel like peak Shyamalan.
Yes,
was at that time. Because I think like The Village came out that year. Also, was that earlier?
I think 2007 might have been Lady in the Water.
Lady in the Water. That's the one that came out in 07. That's right. A Village, I think, was 06. And then, But yeah.
And then Signs was before that. I think. Look,
Signs was
I have the internet
Signs
in front
was
of me,
like
but...
02, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lady in the Water. Children. Paul that was 2006. Giamatti. So right around the same time. But
Okay. But yeah.
Anyway.
That was, anyway.
Regardless, it's... it was definitely that period of time. You're absolutely right. I always forget about the Shyamalan influence and how much. I mean, because even Secret Window is a twist ending.
Oh, yeah.
It's a twist ending you see coming a million miles away.
But tries to have it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a thing about, like, Stephen King writes so much. And full-length novels, but, like, also writes a ton of short stories. Yeah. Not every one of those is going to be amazing.
No.
And, like, but then you have... people making them because it's got Stephen King's name. And so like, he, yeah. you know, he's not above doing weird twist endings. And so like, yeah.
well, especially it's like with those like shorter, like novellas or short stories, it's just like, you're trying to adapt a short story into a feature length film. It's like, I haven't watched it yet, but I know like The Boogeyman that just came out last year. Have you seen
yeah,
it?
I did. Yeah.
Is it good?
I didn't really like it. But I really like the short story.
That's it. The short story is amazing.
Yeah. And so little of the movie is the short story. Like,
yeah.
The scene in which the, you know, because if you haven't read the short story, it's about a father who goes to a psychiatrist kind of out of the blue, just walks in and starts describing this ordeal he's been going through with this, you know, this creature, this boogeyman creature that lives in the dark of his house and everything like that. It's been terrorizing his family and like, I think even killing his family and just like doing bad stuff.
Yeah.
And then like the kind of thing in that story is that he thinks that he's in a safe space, but he's not. Like, it's one of those. That's only such a small part of the movie.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is the psychiatrist's family going through the net. Like, he's passed it on to him and stuff. And it's just like, you know, like, it just didn't do much for me. And also, like, I know I might be kind of alone in this or whatever, but like, I thought the movie Smile was tremendous. I really liked it.
I still have not seen Smile.
It's, you know what? I thought it was really, really effective.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of stuff in The Boogeyman that feels derivative of other movies like Smile or something like that, where there's a creature and there's, you know, something kind of latching itself onto a person or a family and kind of just, you know, whatever. And it's, I thought the creature design was a little too close to like A Quiet Place for me, like, not to spoil what the creature looks like in The Boogeyman.
Oh,
but like,
I think I did see a photo of it. I think I did see a photo of what the creature looks like.
And the whole, I mean, the thing about the Boogeyman idea that makes it so scary is that it's weirdly sentient. It's not just a monster, you know, it's not just a beast.
Oh yeah, it's and like tormenting the guy in the book or in the,
and so
in
it's
the,
like
the
it felt
story.
Like it was you can't have it both ways, where like, so it's a beast that's like lives in the shadows, but then it's also like, and then Cobweb. Did you see Cobweb last year?
No.
Cobweb is a mess, but it does a lot of the same stuff that Boogeyman also did.
Yeah.
Except that one does have like a, there's a girl in the wall who, you know, whatever. It's just, kind of kid horror, but
my like impression of like Boogeyman was it was like a very like dumbed down American version of the Babadook. From it.
You know, Chris Messina is the main dad in it, you know, the psychiatrist, and David Dismalchin plays the tormented father
at the
beginning.
From the,
and then
the
you have Sophie Thatcher from Yellow Jackets, who's effectively the lead in it. She's the eldest daughter of
The main reason I wanted to see it, because I love her in Yellow Jackets.
Yeah, and she's good. She's good. But I just think an imperfect film.
It was supposed to be like a streaming exclusive, like on Hulu, and then it tested so well that they decided to release it theatrically.
Yeah, which is, in fairness, the same thing that happened with Smile, and Smile made a crap ton of money. So like, they were going to just release it to Paramount Plus, but it tested so well that they put it out theatrically, and it just did gangbusters. And you know, 20th Century was just kind of seeing what happened with Smile, so they thought maybe that would work for them. But
yeah.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't hold a candle to like the effectiveness, the punchiness of the short story.
Yeah.
And cause that's the thing that I think is the hardest with Stephen King is he's so good at describing stuff and also so good at showing characters reading stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think one of my favorite parts in the book, The Shining, is when Jack finds all of the history of the Overlook Hotel and like all, you know, who it passed from, like, you know, the mafia was involved and all this stuff, and just like all of the death and you know, horrible atrocities that happened in the hotel after a certain point and all this stuff. And I was like, oh man, I love all that stuff. Like that kind of like the context history of scary places. And that's so hard to convey in a film.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Boogeyman short story is like, it's a guy telling you this horrible thing that happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
But then seeing it outright just isn't as effective to me. Like, I don't know.
Well, that's what I think is similar with like Salem's Lot as well. Cause like you said too, like with the TV movie is like in the novel, like it's a very slow burn movie too, but it's like this sort of like unraveling of like what is going on in this town, and it's so well done in mm-hmm. King's writing. But it's like, yeah, it's like I feel like a lot of people have trouble translating that to screen.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm really excited. I want to see this new Salem Slot movie. We were talking about it before we recorded, but it's just like, I think it's supposed to come out in like 2022 originally before the Discovery merger. And then now it's just been like on an indefinite hold. And I really want to see it because I love Salem Slot.
Yeah, man, it's definitely, I mean, yeah, went into production in 2021 and it just keeps getting pushed and pushed and pushed. Additional photography occurred in May and June of 22, and we still don't have a release date for it. Yeah. So it's very strange.
So I think,
Yeah,
it's like it was, I think I mentioned before this too. It's like, I remember at one point they like put out, a new version of the novel that had like, you know, like mm-hmm. whenever like a movie's coming out of a book, they like usually release a special version of it that has like the poster or whatever and says soon to be a major motion picture. They did that like in 2022. Yeah. And so it's just like, where is it, David Zaslav?
Yeah, what have you done to it? And it was, you know, it's produced by James Wan. Gary Dauberman is the director of it, and he did Annabelle? And Annabelle Creation. And
the nun, an animal comes home.
Yeah. So this guy's the nun, the Annabelle guy. This guy's the nun is what I just said. No, that's not what I meant.
He did co-write. He was the writer on It in It Chapter 2.
Oh, that's true. So, that's true. You know, so he gets it. Dude, this guy gets it. But I do really want to see it. I think like, you know, having the, and it's very much. It speaks to the time because when this was announced, in which, you know, Pilu Osbuk, who's the Danish actor who played Euron Greyjoy on Game of Thrones, he's supposed to be in it. He's playing the vampire, I believe, or the vampire's
familiar. Or is that the right?
And that was very much like, he's really hot shit off of this show. These last two seasons of the show, and then like in the time, because he's also got a very, very tiny part in the second Aquaman movie, which just came out. And I was like, wow, his stuff got cut out. And it's like, oh yeah, it's because that movie got moved around a million times. But it's like, well, now he's not a draw, so like, or he's not, you know, so that he, like there's one scene of him that looks like himself in Aquaman 2. And the rest of the time, I didn't even realize it was him because he's like the monster, you know, the monster bad guy. Anyway, I just find that I find that kind of stuff really interesting.
Yeah, I was just like looking at the cast list for it too. And it's like, yeah, like the guy, Lewis Pullman, who plays the lead, Ben Mears, like, you know, at the time was in like The Strangers Pray by Night and Bad Times at the El Royale, and then was in Top Gun Maverick,
right?
But I don't know what he is. It doesn't seem like he's as hot of a commodity.
Yeah, this will be, I mean, you know, they didn't have like names to go with other than Bill Skarsgård to go with it, and so they kind of,
well, they did, they had a Stranger Things kid.
I guess that's true. He had fame and he was hot. He was his star was rising, Stranger Things kid.
I'm sorry, Stranger Things kid. I don't remember your name.
I mean, how do you forget the name Finn Wolfhard?
How did I forget that name?
It sounds fake.
It does.
So it sounds like somebody asked him. Somebody just found a person. Hey, what's your name? Finn Wolfhard. What? That can't be your name. No, it's my name. I'm going to be a rock star.
Yeah, that does sound like a rock star stage name.
His real name's Nathaniel Schnurpis. I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, so there's a million King things coming up that are TBA, and some of them have directors, some of them don't. So you have Salem's Lot, which we've already mentioned. Billy Summers, which is literally the book came out in 2021. Warner Brothers just optioned it. There's going to be supposedly, we'll see, a remake of Christine, directed by Brian Fuller. We'll see if that happens. Elevation is another, like, it's a 2020 or 2018 King novel that's been adapted or optioned, rather. Yeah. Fairy Tale.
That's
which
one of his
is,
new one. I think it just came out like last year.
Yep. Paul Greengrass is supposed to direct that one.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah.
From a Buick 8, which they've tried a million times, I yeah. feel like, to adapt that one. Super, a supernatural car. Another one with a supernatural car. Jim Mickle is supposed to direct that one, and he directed Stakeland, is probably the thing that vampire like road movie or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Different from the vampire plane movie.
Much different from that. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, which was a 1999 novel, is supposed to be directed by Lynn Ramsey. We'll see if that happens. I love Lynn Ramsey. She's never met me. I admire her work, is what I should say. The Life of Chuck, as we mentioned, is Mike Flanagan. There's yeah. also supposed to be The Little Green God of Agony, which was a short story from 2011 that Lionsgate has the rights to. The Running Man is getting a remake with Edgar Wright supposedly directing. Throttle, which is a 2009 novella that he wrote, King wrote with his son Joe Hill, which HBO Max is supposedly making. We'll see again. And then The Long Walk, nice. Which was a very old, it was a Richard Bachman. That's how old
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
A short story. No, full length novel, but written by Richard Bachman, which yeah. Francis Lawrence, who directed the latter Hunger Games movies, and also I Am Legend, is supposedly directed.
Oh.
And also Constantine. I think Constantine's quite a good movie.
Yeah,
but yeah, yeah, it's wild. It's yeah. wild to think about.
What I just remember too is Welcome to Derry. Is I think they pushed it to next year, but it was originally supposed to come out this year. The HBO Max series that's like a prequel, I think.
Oh, okay, for it,
which I am excited about. I do love, like, one of my favorite things about the novel of it is like how it really, like, the sort of like interlude chapters where it kind of goes into like the history more of Derry. And like how, because, you know, obviously Pennywise has been terrorizing this region for centuries, and so I'm very curious. I know they had like some footage of it in the like at the end of last year, whenever they like put out their like sort of sizzle reel for 2024, and I'm curious about Welcome to Derry.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that was even coming out. Which is, you know,
yeah.
just testament to how much they just make from him all the time. And like,
yeah,
there's Chapel Wait was a short story or a short television series that's sort of based on the short story Jerusalem's Lot, which is a prequel. To
oh yeah, yeah.
Sam's
yeah.
Lot. They made another The Stand. There's The Outsider, which is based on one of his.
Like the HBO series, the book is good.
I was very like confused. Like what is it? Like, cause I know that the character of Holly Gibney is not a supernatural detective by any means. So yeah. it was an interesting choice to like make these kind of series of kind of dark crime novels. Let's make the one that has a supernatural element yeah. to it or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very yeah, weird sort of novel to, yeah. I don't know. I like the novel a lot, but yeah, I was not a huge fan of the HBO show.
Yeah, I wanted to like it more than I did. I thought it had a really interesting premise, and then it was just like, meh.
The first episode is great, where it's like really following the novel, and then, yeah, it kind of goes off the rails fast.
There's been a million sequels to Children of the Corn. There's been several sequels to Carrie, and sometimes they come back, and just like...
Oh, Pet Sematary 2 is
Pet Sematary 2
fantastic.
Is another Mary Lambert movie. That's got mother effing Clancy Brown in it.
Yes. Yes.
Also, have you ever seen a Return to Salem's Lot?
No, I have not.
Written and directed by Larry Cohen. It is just so bad. And it's like, is it trying to be funny or is it just unintentionally funny? It's one of those, but it was made in the late 80s. It's not good. But yeah, I love the fact that, I mean, we obviously there's so much Stephen King media to talk about, you know, yeah. and we haven't even touched on some of it. And like what, you know, there's a whole Creepshow show on yeah. Shudder that you can watch, and not yeah. and some of it is actually directly, you know, taken from Stephen King stories. The rest is not based on King, but
yeah.
I mean, Grey like, Matter and Survivor Type are both really good.
I need to watch the new show. Became
episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. They made Mr. Harrigan's Phone. I just realized I was like looking at this list. I'm like, oh yeah, Netflix put that out. Cause I remember reading that short story, and it's like, it's a fine short story, but again, it's one of those where I'm like, how do you make this into a feature length film?
What is that? Where is
I've yet
that?
To watch it. It's like, I mean, it was fine. It was a fine short story. It's in one of his in his collections that came out in 2020. I think 2020. I think it was 2020. But yeah, it was like the short story is like this kid who befriends like an older man and like buys him an iPhone. Then when cool. the old man dies, he starts getting calls from the phone. And like his bully gets murdered or something. And yeah.
Okay.
It's fine. But yeah, I saw it came out on Netflix last year, and I'm like, I guess 2 years ago. I have not watched it, but again, it's just like some of these short stories, it's like, yeah, sure, it's a fine short story, but like how do you make this into a movie?
How do you? And sometimes you don't, and that's the answer.
Maybe that's sometimes dead is better.
And I think that is a perfect place to leave off. We love Stephen King. You know, share, write us an email at laserfocus@nerdist.com. Tell us what your favorite Stephen King adaptation is, either film or television or both. I like the fact that we're in a world where they keep making Stephen King stuff and he keeps yeah. writing stuff. And it's just because he's so influential. Like I cannot think of another author. Maybe you're getting closer with like George R.R. Martin just because of the success of Game of Thrones, but nobody's yeah. going back and reading. Not nobody. He's written a ton of other stuff. Yeah. Martin has, but like, if it's not in the Westeros, people actually kind of don't care that much yeah. about it. Whereas King, like just, all I mean, the time people are at least interested in it, whether yeah. whether they, you know, Under the Dome is like a flawed television series
yeah.
but they still did it and they still keep making these things based I mean, on like, his work.
How many novels has King written in the time it's taken?
Oh,
there's this next book.
I know there's that video you can find where there's like an interview between King and or it's just maybe it's just a panel between King and Martin where King is talking about how like his writing process and stuff yeah. like that. And George R. R. Martin literally just goes, how do you write that much? Yeah. Like, and it's just so funny because, yeah, King writes it's maybe not amazing every single time, but he writes and puts out so much stuff.
Yeah.
And our friend George, I've never met George, he keeps having to put out statements like, I am still working on the book and I know I'm yeah. not close to death. Please don't worry. Like, and that's not a good sign.
No, we have to assure people that you are not at death's door or will live long enough to finish. That's, not going to be good for your self-esteem.
If you had, one off the beaten path, either film or TV movie or something like that to recommend to people to watch. One that's not like of the main like top five that generally people talk about. What one would you recommend to people?
Oh, of a Stephen King.
Of a Stephen King. Yeah.
Of Stephen King.
Probably Cell. Just kidding. That movie's not good.
I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, like I've been rattling off so many. Like I said, In the Tall Grass is one that I feel like I don't hear many people talking about, but I enjoyed. I think it's really interesting, kind of trippy Netflix one. You know, that or Gerald's Game. Gerald's Game is absolutely like one of my top five Stephen King adaptations.
This was my bad for not mentioning it. Earlier, I just kind of glazed over it, but I'm going to say the 1985 film Silver Bullet. Everybody should watch that one.
Oh, Silver Bullet.
I just rewatched that the Halloween season. That was actually Cycle of the Werewolf was the first King novel I ever read. It's a very short novel, and I read it because it was, you know, in my high school library. And
yeah,
it had like really great Bernie Wrightson illustrations. But that movie rocks. I don't care what anybody says. I think it's actually great. It's got an excellent Gary Busey performance. It's got a really good Corey Haim performance.
That's right.
And Megan Fellows from Anne of Green Gables is the other person in it. And also Everett McGill. And I mean, it's just got a great cast of like faces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, or Pets, Pet Sematary 2 is the other one I would say. It's like
Pet Sematary 2.
It's not necessarily, but I don't know. I love like I love Pet Sematary and I love Pet Sematary 2. It's so 90s.
With Eddie Furlong. Who's the dad in that one? Is there a dad?
I think that is oh my god. The dad is Clancy. Well, he's the stepdad.
The stepdad, that's right.
Yeah.
I just remember that shot of him with like gunk coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, after he gets brought back. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just remember like, cause like I had my sister's like best friend growing up was her whole family were like huge Stephen King Stephen King fans. And so like usually whenever they would have sleepovers, her and her friend would watch Stephen King movies. And occasionally I would like sneak in and like watch part of it. And I just remember in Pet Sematary 2, there's a scene where Clancy Brown, like his stepson is being like bullied. And so like, he has like a motorbike, and after he's been like killed and brought back or whatever, he like uses the motorbike and like revs it on the kid's face. And I remember that like distinctly in my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, we forgot to mention Thinner. Anyway, we're not talking about that one. I curse you, Thinner. Very dumb. All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening. Allie, how can people get a hold of you on the internet? Should you choose to be gotten? Nope.
You can find me on Instagram is probably the main one. I'm at That Spooky Allie on Instagram and Threads, I guess. I don't post anything on there, but and nor am I on X. But you can find me on Instagram and the occasional Nerdist thing on the YouTubes and wherever fine Stephen King novels are sold.
Yeah, you just stand in bookstores.
You'll find Stephen King me in section. The Stephen King section.
She's here. She's here. That's when people go to the store. You go to different stores. She'll be at one of them. You can follow me on Instagram if you choose at functional_nerd. You can follow me on Letterboxd at Kyle_Anderson. Please do that. I've been watching a lot of Jackie Chan movies lately, and those are a lot of fun. Also January Jallo, so a lot of Jallo movies. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Allie, for being on the show, as always. Thank you all for listening to Laser Focus. I'm Kyle Anderson. Join me again next time when my guest will be a different person. Bye-bye. Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.